I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In 1966, Jan Wenner, suburban Jewish son of a businessman, dropped out of Berkeley. Neither a rebel nor a flower child, he was drawn to rock, the music of generational grievance. Wenner would become the baby boomer's go-to analyst of that music and the culture that produced it. He just needed his mouthpiece. A year after leaving college, from a small apartment on San Francisco's Potrero Hill, Wenner decided to found a magazine.
I borrowed money from my mother-in-law, my stepmother, and scraped together $7,500. And we just sort of got some free office space in a printer in San Francisco and had no expenses, no salaries, nothing. Just, you know, it was kind of hand-to-mouth for a while.
And you published how? What?
We had enough money to pay the printer's bill. And since it was printed on 24 pages, a really cheap newsprint, the bill was relatively low.
So you have something that resembles what now? What did Rolling Stone then look like?
It looked like
the Village Voice now.
Tabloid size, you know, like a Village Voice size with
paper.
Paper and with a front page rather than a cover, which was a later kind of thing that we put on. And it was 24 pages, and we set up in the corner 25 cents, our price cheap, which I took from Mad Magazine.
Right. And what changed? How does it start to build? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think that it started to build because of the editorial excellence. Because in 1967, the leading edge of the baby boom was just turning 21, 22. The Beatles were still in their mop pop phase. Dylan was doing Highway 61. So rock and roll wasn't covered in the newspapers or television in the movie. It was nowhere else except on the jukeboxes, on the radio. It started to build because we were starting to do articles about music that musicians and serious music fans were recognizing as being really important stuff. Stuff they wanted to know from the musicians about how they created their music, what they were trying to say. And other kinds of stories about cultural issues that people recognize as being really good. I mean, within our first year, we had presented a two-part interview with Pete Townsend, a big, long interview that I had done with him in which he articulated Tommy for the first time. We had Mick Jagger on the cover. Now, mind you, we're this tiny little thing in San Francisco, and for our first anniversary issue, John and Yoko gave us the naked picture of themselves that was banned on their Two Versions album.
And who are less than a year old, 22. How do you get them to do that?
They liked the magazine. They saw what we were doing.
Literally that.
They liked it. I didn't know any of them, you know. You kind of met them. No, and there was no, yet. And then there was no publicity machinery, no record company, all this stuff we now call the star-making machinery. Didn't really exist then. You know, the communication were generally directly with artists, and we'd send copies of issues, and they'd see it, and they'd go, oh, I like that, you know, John Yoko. That magazine's about music. It's taking it seriously, you know. It's taking us seriously. You know, we were reviewing Beggar's Banquet and saying what we thought of that in their Satanic Majesty, and we got a letter from Charlie Watts early on saying, geez, we're sorry you didn't like it. We'll try and do better.
It's funny.
It wasn't through any business acumen. It wasn't because I knew how to market or knew anything about business. I knew nothing about business. Or publishing.
Who did?
Nobody.
Who helped you take it to the next level? How does it go to the next level?
It just kind of grew on its own, you know, through trial and error. I made so many mistakes.
Name one.
Oh, my God. Let's see. Spending fortunes moving into huge offices with no idea of how we're going to pay for the overhead, hiring the wrong people, putting on ad campaigns at, you know, the wrong time. They were small mistakes then. They got to be larger and larger over those years.
But you're
proceeded.
Learning the magazine. Your father was not in publishing.
Not at all. My mom was a writer, and she taught me how to kind of edit and a lot about writing. But I was the editor of my high school yearbook, and then I worked for NBC News when I was in college. So I had journalistic experience, but absolutely no business experience.
Right.
You know, and it was trial and error, you know. And we would only spend cash that we had on hand.
You didn't have to go, you didn't look for investors and people to buy a piece of
it. We did at various times, but after the fact, and always at the point at which we didn't really need it, but it seemed like a good idea.
Right. You know, I've worked in movies and television for years, and you always hear people talk about the music business as being the worst of all these businesses in terms of the corruption and in terms of the, you know, the old payola and people trying to launch musical careers that way. Did you find that that was a big problem for you as the magazine got to be more successful? People wanted to use you to enhance people's careers?
I mean, obviously, you know, there were some pressure to cover this or do a cover on this or get a good review, but very little. I mean, through the first 10 years of Rolling Stone, we were in San Francisco before we got to New York. We were relatively isolated from the music business, which was in Los Angeles and New York. So we were kind of an afterthought. You know, we weren't. If we had been in L.A. and been in the thick of the music business, things would have been much different. But we weren't. We were isolated. And by the time we became a bigger factor, and by the time we got to New York, our reputation was that we weren't going to be persuaded by money or favors or interviews or anything like that. That we were independent and fiercely so, and would just say whatever the fuck, whatever we wanted to say, and we weren't going to be held back. So if you were to try and approach us and bribe us with something or other.
I'm sure they tried, though.
Not really, because by this time, it was very clear you don't do that to Rolling Stone. Right. You know, Rolling Stone's going to, you do that, we're going to write about it. We're going to say, guess who showed up with $10,000. So that never was a problem, strangely enough. And I'd say one other thing about the music business. I just thought it was a great business, as opposed to, say, the television business, where my experience in television was that I had never seen so many two-faced people in my life.
Really?
In those days of networks, they were lowest common denominator, and the people were lowest common denominator. Right. And then people in the record business were always having fun, you know, hanging out with the Stones and the Beatles and whatever, and that's what I gravitated towards.
What's changed in terms of, because the music business now is just doesn't resemble the music business 40 years
different.
Ago.
When I started, it was pretty much independent labels run by the people who founded those labels or founded the music business. Like, I guess, the early days of the movie business. Right. You know, and they had a lot of control. Over the years, it's evolved into there are four major record companies. They're owned by huge corporations, and they have sound business practices and accounting standards that have to meet in the New York Stock Exchange type publicly listed company thing. So the opportunities are not there. And on top of that, they're not the dominant factor in selling records anymore.
What is?
Well, radio play continues to be, but all this internet stuff, streaming services, downloading services, are, you know, huge distributors of music.
How was that for you in terms of, is it the 80s, is it the 90s, when you say to yourself, I'm not really keeping up with this anymore?
It evolves slowly. Absolutely, the phenomenon is true. Like, what is going on today in music by today's artists that have developed over the last 5 or 6 years, I'm not really that up on. I'm totally up on U2, for example. But that's all, and they've got a new record out, and it's great. And I just finished at this very table doing an interview with Bono last week, which is going to be the next cover. So I'm still involved, you know, with the things I love. But I don't.
But you have people that keep up, obviously.
Younger people. You know, like Lauren, I'm an old guy. I mean, there was a time when you could predict what was going to be on SNL that week, going to be the same thing that we were doing on the cover of Rolling Stone. So people would come to town, they'd go to 30 Rock for that stuff, and they'd come over to our shop, which is a block away, and do that. And when I see what Lauren's got on SNL now, I don't really know who most of them are, except for, you know, the occasional, what do you call it, heritage act, like U2, you know. But the great things about heritage acts is they're as vital as ever. I mean, Springsteen is just brilliant and more relevant than ever.
Did you see Springsteen's show?
Yes.
You did. What'd you think?
I think it's great.
It was haunting, I heard.
I mean, Bruce, it can shake the last seat in the highest rafters in a place that's got 60,000 people in it.
Right.
And so put him in a place that's got 800 people. And the intensity of his performance and his personality. And Bruce is just a remarkable... I'm having lunch with him, in fact, as soon as we're done.
What is it about that period?
Something happened there with the Beatles, the Stones, and Dylan all being on the stage at the same time that is reminiscent of Paris in the 20s, when you had Picasso, Matisse, Leger, all working at one
it's
time.
It's a confluence
in one place
of stars, of artists.
That hasn't happened since. May happen again, another field in 10 years, something like that, but you had that. Then you also have the phenomenon, which is what you listen to between the time you are 18 and 22 is your favorite music for the rest of your life and will remain that always.
Sure.
And that's why you will always turn to that. Because after 22, as you get into the business of working or having a family, you know, your ability to spend so much time involved with that music gets more and more limited and you get less familiar with it. And of course, then there's the evolution of the music itself into forms and formats that are technologically driven or commercially driven and are youth driven, you know, that are different than what your imperatives are now. Mm-hmm. I don't myself, I'm not a big rap fan. I've listened to it. I understand the genius of it and the absolute importance of it. I mean, talking about a tribal telegraph that communicated with a disenfranchised group of people. I mean, if you were listening to NWA, it's profound, important.
They were onto something, yeah. When did you mark that when Rolling Stone became Rolling Stone?
Well, early on, I mean, we took as our franchise popular culture at large, thinking that we were going to learn more about what society is about from what was happening in popular culture, say, than what was happening in the church or in politics. And then, of course, we started covering politics early on, and our first big hit in politics was in 72 when we sent Hunter Thompson out to cover the presidential campaign.
What did you make of him? Because the Thompson, for me, only exists as like Johnny Depp in some Baroque kind of a movie. What was he really like?
Hunter was Hunter was a crazy person in many ways, but on the other hand, really responsible, you know, thoughtful. He was a Southern gentleman, a charmer, and extraordinarily talented and charismatic, and you loved being with him. Not only because he was so charming and so funny, but also if you were close to him, you felt when hanging out with him, this is as close to the danger zone and the edge as you're ever going to get. Truly. You know, and so there's an excitement to that. I mean, one night we were driving from in Massachusetts from Cambridge up to Maine, where we're going from staying in Dick Goodwin's house in Cambridge to see Norman Mailer in Maine. And we drive up in the middle of the night, head full of acid, you know, both of us in the car. And he turns off the headlights. He liked playing pranks and being a jokester and practical jokes on people. And so he was enormously fun and enormously talented. He was difficult to work with because he was time consuming and a little bit unforgiving in his demands on you as an editor, but I loved every minute of it.
What were demands in terms of his expense account or his word count?
His expense account and the word count was great. I just let him, we run anything. In terms of just the demands on your time and your emotional strength and your stamina.
Needy.
I mean, at 3 o'clock in the morning, your phone rings. You know, well, I've got to have this, goddammit, and, you know, I'm running out of this, and who do you people think you are? And, you know, I mean, Hunter, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm sleeping.
Right.
He doesn't even hear you say that.
Right.
You know, so it was a full-time job to edit Hunter. And during that campaign in 72, the whole business of Rolling Stone came to a halt because I couldn't pay attention to that. All I could do was edit Hunter for a year, you know, and
literally
pay attention to him and his needs. And then, you know, on the side, run the company. And it was worth it.
Right. He was worth it.
We became just dearest friends forever and ever until he killed himself. And
where were you when you found that out?
I was in Sun Valley, you know, in my house, and somebody called me and, you know, made me cry and all that stuff.
But you weren't surprised?
No, because Hunter by that time was virtually unable to walk. He was incontinent. He had had a series of real serious health setbacks between all the drug use and abuse he had done to his body. And he was really, honestly, within 2 months or so of being committed to a home.
Yeah.
I mean, where he would...
He was falling apart.
Yeah, he was falling apart. And he would be... And once he was committed, he'd be trapped. I never second-guessed his
But you
decision.
Mentioned you're driving down the unlit road with him and everybody's dropping acid. Obviously, drugs. Was that another thing that you had to keep an eye on, which was that you didn't go down the tubes like these other people?
I mean, I think that it was very, very destructive for some people. Hunter destroyed him.
Right.
I mean, it crippled him physically in the end, but also really killed his ability to write. But luckily, most people finally somehow or other found the means to get it under control. For myself, I just...
You were built differently, maybe?
Maybe built differently, or more sense of responsibility,
right. Or
I had an agenda, which I had to do Rolling Stone. It was becoming incompatible with drug use, but I think it has to do with age and getting worn out, and certainly it has to do with having kids. I mean, if you have kids and you want to enjoy your children, you cannot be getting up at noon.
You can't be drunk every night.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, you'll never see them.
right.
No. So.
Or they'll get taken away from you.
Yeah, or they get taken away. So it was kind of an abrupt thing, and I think the amount of drug casualties we've seen are relatively, really few, given the size of the scope of the drug use.
And yet you resist, you know, you don't go...
Well, I mean, I didn't altogether resist.
Right.
But
overall?
Overall, yeah.
Could have been worse.
It could have been worse. And I saw many people go through this and come out fine, you know. But, I mean, if you look back at all the cocaine use, you have to say part of it was fun.
Yeah,
you know, and
then it stops being fun.
That's a real true story of our times. There was a period where everybody we knew was taking cocaine.
Sure,
you couldn't go out without running into it. At least in arts, you know, circles at that end, and it's forgotten now.
Explore the Here's the Thing archives
Lorne Michaels runs his own kind of empire, and it's all on television.
For me, commercial television and those boundaries, I like it. I like that you can't use certain language. I like that you have to be bright enough to figure out how to get your ideas across in that amount of time, with intelligence being the thing that you hope is showing.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Now, more from my conversation with Rolling Stone owner, for now, Jan Wenner. He's decided to put the magazine up for sale. This turning point is a chance to reflect on the artists he spent his life among.
Are you like the head of an agency? Are you like the head of a studio where these people are your friends, but it's more business, and there's kind of the cloak of friendship around it in terms of business?
Well, there's always, the initial introduction is always about business, you know? And after many years of knowing somebody really well, all that kind of drops away. And it's really about just the friendship and the relationship and the vacations together and all that stuff. So there's a number of, I'll not throw up the names now, a very rare thing.
Well, pick a couple of people who you met royalty in music. Who impressed you?
All the best people impressed me. I mean, you're talking about people who are incredibly talented and creative. And people who are incredibly talented and creative are generally fascinating, charismatic personalities and great fun to hang out with, you know. And I am in awe of talent. I really cherish it. It's valuable. It's something I celebrate. It's what Rolling Stone celebrates. But you know, I've known Mick for 49 to 50 years. I've been doing this. And he's his own, he's sui generis. I mean, he's an extraordinary individual. There's no one else like him who has that level of charisma, who's not only as talented as an artist and a singer, but also as a businessman, a producer of the concerts, a producer of everything. I mean, so he's something I kind of hold him in awe and still do. On the other hand, we have vacationed together so many times, you know, and we've been in each other's house so much and have such a good, nice friendship.
What the hell do you do on vacation with Mick Jagger? You guys, like, you cook?
No, we just...
Have people who cook.
You have people who...
What do you do?
Well, there's a lot of boats if you're going to the Caribbean, and there's a lot of sailing, and there's a lot of hanging out, and there's a lot of meals, you know, and sometimes they're a little smoking and dope, and then watch a movie. The most fun with Mick, in a way, I mean, doesn't happen all the time, is sitting around a campfire singing, where he brings his guitar. We go for a picnic, you know, 5, 6, 7, or 8 of us, and then he sits down and
sings. I want to sing by the campfire with Mick.
And, you know, I say, well, Play No Expectations, he does that. And then we sang a Dylan song together. And, you know, it's just rare and extraordinary times.
An interesting thing for me, because you know Jagger really, really well, is so the Beatles are red hot and they're really producing records for, it's less than a decade.
61, 62 through 67.
Yeah, 67. And the Stones go on forever. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Why does one band...
Well, you know, I think with the Beatles, you had a very volatile personality in John. You had an extraordinary level of popularity and intensity that nobody has ever had before or since. And I think that pressure made it really difficult for them to stay together. And as drugs came along, that's when they broke up. You know, I mean, I think drugs exacerbated their differences.
How did the Stones survive 50 years
later?
Well,
first off, the Stones broke up, really. Nobody knows it. But they, you know, throughout the 80s, you know, they didn't tour. They didn't make records. You know, they were functionally broken up. And I think that Mick was really persistent about wanting to find the opportunity when they could get back together again. And he was able to effect a reconciliation with Keith. And, you know, but that whole period, again, drugs, that whole period... Keith was taking drugs for 10, 12 years and impossible to work with. You know, I mean, if somebody's stoned all the time, you just can't go in the studio. You can't write together. You can't do anything together. You can't even plan a tour together. You don't know if the guy's going to be busted in Canada or not, or is he going to show up on stage and all those things. So all those difficulties drove them apart. And they just had to wait out the drug period.
Right.
And now I think both Keith and Mick went solo, tried to see what it was like, and it wasn't going to work.
It's better together.
And that people wanted to see them together. And so they, you know, despite all, and despite Keith's book, they've been able to work again together. And they do. And they both happen to love being on the road. You know, Mick loves to sing. He's a musician.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end of the day, Mick likes to sit around, play guitar, talk about music.
And Mick apparently functions as kind of an almost quasi-management component, whereas you look at the Beatles and you say, when Epstein died,
they didn't have
everything started to fall apart,
yeah.
And there's a vacuum there. Who's going to tell everybody what time to go to the studio? We got to get a record made. You got to do this. We got to go to work.
Also, the Beatles, there was a struggle over the leadership. I mean, Paul wanted to be in charge. John let him, but it was...
But complained.
They didn't have a wise voice telling him what to do. And Mick is... Among all other things, is incredibly sober,
smart businessman.
Yeah. You know, who sees the bigger picture. I did this interview with Mick, the only big long interview he's ever given, which we did finally because he's not a guy given to that type of stuff. But I just finally said to him, "This took place out in Long Island, Amagansett." I said, "You know, we really should do this because I mean, we know each other so well, and we kind of owe it to history to sit down and take the opportunity to
lay it down, who wrote
this and wrote that and." You know, I mean, nobody's better to do that right now than me. I mean, we trust each other. So anyway, so we do the interview. One of the questions was, he said, what do you think about when you're on stage, you know, and you're singing? You know, when do you get in the moment? When are you out of the moment? He says, most of the time I'm up there singing along and I think, thinking to myself, God, did I remember to get the leaves out of the gutter back home?
Like everybody.
Yeah, he said, mostly though, I'm looking at the girls.
Now, Lennon, obviously, was he someone you were close to as well?
No, not nearly as close. Not, no. I mean, first off, he died in 1980. I met him in the late 60s, and we began a correspondence and an acquaintanceship. And I visited his house. He came out to San Francisco to visit with us. And then I did that big interview with him. And after that, we had a little bit of a falling out. Because I printed that interview as a book. He didn't want to publish as a book, but I felt it was my right to publish a book. It was a super historic document. And that book is still in print. And in fact, the last edition of it, Yoko wrote the introduction to it. And, you know, and it's an interesting book, an interesting interview, because he talks about how it was the first time he had ever discussed the Beatles and what it was really like inside and what pain and misery it was for him at that time. But he's like all of... When we did an interview, I was like 24, and he's like 27 or something like that. And it's we're so young, making such big pronouncements about life. But after that, wasn't really friends. We'd be in touch and communication letters back and forth. But he was living in New York, I was living in San Francisco, and didn't see much of him at the end. But I consider him to have been a friend and an ally. I mean, He did many great things for Rolling Stone. In addition to, he gave us that interview and the Two Virgins cover and all sorts of things throughout the
year. What about Dylan?
Bob's another case. Bob is, I consider, a friend and a colleague, and we've had a wonderful relationship for years, for the whole history of Rolling Stone. And it's not like we hang... He did come to my house once, and we spent the day together in Idaho. It was fantastic. And I watched him playing guitar with my little son and all that stuff. But we've had a really good, supportive relationship. I mean, I think the mission of Rolling Stone, in great part, was always to present Bob to an audience, to his audience, to the audience at large. I mean, his name, Rolling Stone, after all. And we viewed him, and I viewed him, as really the most important writer of our times and most talented songwriter. And, I mean... above and beyond everybody else. And so we were kind of an ambassador for him to his audience, and I felt part of our mission was always to be presenting Bob to our audience, and I think Bob saw that and understood that. Despite all the reputation of Bob being reclusive and silent all the time, he's done 14 major interviews over the years with Rolling Stone. I've done two of them myself, and we have cherished him and supported him and criticized him as necessary, where our writers didn't like self-portrait or didn't like this thing or that thing, but been supportive. I mean, without Bob Dylan, nothing. You know, I mean, there's no Rolling Stone, there's no rock and roll, you know, without him.
Now, what's the provenance of the name Jan for a Jewish kid from Northern California? Where does Jan come from?
My parents, like, fans of Jan Sibelius, the composer.
So you named it for Sibelius?
Yes. My mother played piano. She played classical music. We grew up listening to her play Mozart and Chopin and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of classical music around. They also had these sets of 78 records and like books, like sleeves. And I remember offhand South Pacific, Odetta, you know, a couple other musicals.
Jazz.
Billie Holiday. No jazz. It was, you know, kind of show tunes, classical music, and folk music. And that's what I grew up with.
And you grew up on?
I grew up with that. And then when the rock and roll thing came around, when I was about 8 or 9, was about, you know, I was 8 in 1950.
And grab hold of what?
First record I ever bought was Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley. And along with my first 45 record player. And I was 8 years old at the time, or 7. And this kind of got into that rock and roll thing and the radio and all the stuff. And it was the time of Pat Boone and Elvis Presley and the Everlys. And we'd hear all that. And that's still music today that I can still know every word to every song. And
the first one for me was Twist and Shout. Now, certainly these last many years, there's been changes in the culture. There's been changes in your life as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Elton John kind of authorized you to out him in a magazine.
Yes.
And yet you were living your life a completely different way back then, correct? Mm-hmm. Was it difficult for you?
No, it wasn't really.
To live your life the way you formerly did? Was it stressful?
No, you know, I was never that conflicted about it.
Right.
Because it wasn't that big an issue. I kind of had a happy marriage. Was
that's who you were then.
So I was fine and, you know, all that. And I wasn't really thinking of doing anything radical or coming out or throwing my life over. But then I met somebody. It felt natural and it felt easy because I was kind of in the circumstance where these things are relatively easy. And I didn't think it all through. I'm impulsive and the environment was supportive. And it was a little crazy at first, you know, with all the publicity was trying to swirl around about it and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, sooner or later, you know, everybody kind of reconciled to the idea and accepted it. And I never lost a friend because of it. I've never changed friends.
And your adult kids?
Yeah, my kids were in high school and were in grammar school at that time, my oldest kids. I remember one of my kids coming home and said, Daddy, at school, they told me they said you were being gay with someone. But, you know, it's the right thing to do. And Elton, I remember, I saw that he had said that, and I did call him up and say, you sure you want to say this? You know what you're saying? Just to double check, you know, because it's personal and private, and I think in a great sense, part of our job is to be protective of artists, you know, and nurture their art, you know. So I just wanted to give him that courtesy. But a lot of it's worked out.
But so you're married.
I'm married. I have
so you and Matt are married. You have three kids together.
Yeah.
What went into that decision?
Well, something you
both wanted?
Yeah. Yeah.
You wanted another round of that.
Yeah. I love children. I wanted to have a big family. And, you know, I had three children with Jane. And then Matt helped raise them, you know, when we split them half the time. And he was deeply involved and wanted to go on. He's from a family of 10 kids.
Where's he from?
Detroit.
What kind of work does he do?
Raises a family now. But before that, he was working for Calvin. And, you know, kids are, if you love them, they're great, you know.
Wait, are these our special guest stars? Who's this?
Oh.
Are these both yours? Are they both yours?
I'm talking about you guys.
Are these both yours?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You just entered on kids.
Who did I write which one's Jude? I wrote your autograph here, and I wrote, I'm Alec, by the way.
I know.
Nice to meet you. How are you? I wrote to you, I wrote, why would you want my autograph when your dad is Jan Wenner?
Because he's met you, I haven't, it's not fair.
Well, it's very nice. We're talking all about you.
Yeah, we were just talking about raising kids.
I just want you to know I watch every one of your Trump skits.
Oh my God, isn't it crazy?
Yes.
It's so crazy. It's huge. So, I'm not doing right, but I must say I'm getting very tired of it, you know?
The Trump stuff has been brilliant up to like, it was more slapsticky, Trump in the shower.
Right.
Which
silly.
Didn't get the thing that has made Trump so great in addition to your skill at it is that it's gotten so to the truth of who he is.
Right.
And what he does, it's this almost real. You know, you're not in danger to threaten by
are we losing them?
Hey guys.
Out. It's nice to meet you both. It's very nice to meet you.
Kiss black.
Thank you.
I call what you're describing what I call is I mean, I say it's the miracle of human life. That you see every day, and to watch them grow is a miracle. And you're, as a parent, you're exposed to that on a constant basis. And that's what's so glowing and special about it.
But, and also, let's face it, at your age, at my age, I tell people all the time, how many more premieres can I go to? Mm-hmm. How many more award shows do I need to go to? I mean, I've done enough of that in the last 30 years. But anyway, Graydon has walked away. Tina Brown is not publishing anymore. She's looking more into multimedia. And now you're going to, the remaining piece you own, you want to sell.
We're going to sell it, but I don't anticipate walking away from it. You know, I'm still have contributions to make and still understand certain things. So, you know, I mean, that's slow. I'm not going to walk away from it.
What's a Rolling Stone cover that Jan Wenner might have on the wall above his?
Probably is that famous picture Annie took of John and Yoko the weekend that he was killed, then curled up together.
It was that same weekend?
That was that weekend, yeah. It was like 24 hours before she shot that picture.
So if I show up at the campfire with you and Mick, you said you and Mick would sing, he'd break out the guitar and sing No Expectations.
That's, I immediately call Mick and suggest
tell that. Mick, please tell him, save a space on the log for me by the fire, okay?
Deal.
That was Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner with cameos from Noah and Jude. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.